Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Kiss those lips and sing, I love you. But chances are you won't give me a chance to be with you. But chances are you won't give me a chance to be with you.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? Glitterock's premier feel-good country band, the Salty Dogs, have played countless shows, sharing the stage with Junior Brown, Hank Williams Jr., and Old Crow Medicine Show, just to name a few. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack in the River Market District of downtown Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my left here, playing for us tonight, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak, and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, so tonight's featured artist is Carla McGoldrick, and our featured piece is this piece right over here, or the one on top, entitled Well Run Down, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Carla at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories all center around our writers stumbling into the unexpected. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Tyler Thompson has two levels of surprise, and we'll end the night with Deb Cantrell and an unexpected discharge. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Ryan Howell and a discovery he didn't see coming in How to Meet a Witch.
I met my first witch when I was 23 years old. She was there lying on the ground beneath me, dead and dismembered, her body parts strewn about this small room. Now, before you go and call the cops to report a murderer on the loose, you should know that I'm an archaeologist, and I have been for several years. And this particular witch that I met was during an excavation I was doing in an ancestral Pueblo village outside of Winslow, Arizona. Some of you might be familiar with Winslow, Arizona, as there is a corner you can stand on with a mighty fine sight to see. This was an excavation at an ancestral Pueblo or Anasazi village. If you picture back in grade school to your history classes, your teacher would have shown you a slide of an old apartment building surrounded by desert, but an apartment building that was made of mud and sandstone and brick and straw. This would have been a multi-level structure that used giant pine beams for its flat-topped roofs. And instead of staircases going around the outside leading up to the different levels, there would have been these rickety old ladders that just leaned against the walls. This particular apartment complex or pueblo was about 800 years old. And we could tell that date almost exactly down to the day because we can date the tree rings in those giant pine trees that they used in their flat-topped roofs. Time and Mother Nature, however, had taken their respective tolls on this pueblo, and it no longer stood tall, but it had fallen in on itself, and now looked like a pile of rubble out on the horizon. As the excavation started, we began uncovering the remains of what would have been the ground floor of this pueblo, which likely stood three stories high when it was occupied all those many hundreds of years ago. It was my job to excavate just one of these rooms, And on the first day of excavation, I sat there surrounded by my buckets and my shovels and my little mason's trowels and all the other tools I would need for the excavation. You start an archaeological excavation the way you start digging anything. You move one shovel full of dirt, followed by another, followed by another. When you excavate a room that has been filled in with rubble and blowing sands from 800 years of abandonment, it takes quite a while. Week after week, I spent moving bucket of dirt after bucket of dirt with nothing exciting to report. The room I was excavating in was about 10 feet by 10 feet, and it didn't have a door. Doors in some of the rooms in these pueblos were actually located in the roofs. You could only move from one room to the next by climbing up one of those rickety ladders through a hole in the roof, walking over the roof, and then down another ladder into the next room. I had removed most of the dirt in the room, and I had about 10 inches to go before I hit what I thought might be the floor. I was shoveling, and then I hit a bone. Now, when an archaeologist uncovers a bone, it's usually not a big deal. Most of the time, it's a rabbit bone or a deer bone. But in this instance, it was a little too big to be either of those, and I thought I might have a human remain. I immediately stopped digging with my shovel and my bucket and moved to start excavating with a small mason's trowel and a dustpan to take the dirt away. The excavation slowed down to a crawl. Now it was much more detailed and much, much more careful. It took me another 2 full weeks to remove the rest of the dirt from the room and expose that body that lied there on the floor. Hip bones weren't where they were supposed to be. They were up by the head. An arm bone was located in an opposite corner from its pair. Ribs were scattered everywhere. She had been killed and dismembered by the people of this pueblo some 800 years ago. I say she, but how do I know she was a she? Well, I could tell by analyzing what remained of the hip bones, the pelvic girdle, to be specific. As you may know, women have larger hip bones to allow for the birthing of children. I could also tell by analyzing her bones that these were the remains of a 12 or 13-year-old girl, because some of the ends of the bones hadn't yet fused. However, 3 things were missing from the skeletal remains: the head and both of the hands. All the other body parts could be accounted for except for the head and the hands. We know from the lore of the area that this is how witches were dispatched in the past. When a witch was found in this community, they were put to death like we did so many years ago in Salem, Massachusetts. The evil source of power of the witch was believed to be in her head and her hands, which were chopped off and then burned and buried separately from the body. The body would be then dismembered and put into a room. The room would be sealed off, never to be gone into again. A tomb inside that pueblo that could be watched to make sure the powers of that witch did not return. This is the body I was excavating. This was the room I was in. A witch and her tomb. There was nothing else in the room except the body. As I was carefully uncovering the bones, something caught my eye. There on the floor with her remains was a tiny, polished deer toe bone. And it was polished like it had been rubbed, smoothed, and handled for many years. At the time, I thought it was a little strange that this was the only other artifact on the floor. But as a good archaeologist, I documented it in my paperwork, bagged it, tagged it, and put it out of my mind. A couple of weeks later, I was in a pottery shop on the Native American reservation just to the north of that pueblo. Now, archaeological evidence says that the members of this reservation were indeed the modern ancestors of the pueblo that I was excavating in. There was an old Native woman standing behind the counter in this pottery shop, and on the windowsill right behind her were about a half dozen deer toe bones. And so I asked the woman, I said, why do you have those dear toe bones. And she explained to me that in her village, the women would traditionally wear these smocks that covered them from shoulder to foot. And then they would put their hair up in these butterfly buns, similar to what Princess Leia wore, but a lot more dramatic. And if you look, if you are familiar with what a deer toe bone looks like, it actually does look a lot like one of these native women in their traditional dress. And she told me that all the girls of her village, when they were growing up, would play with these deer toe bones as their dolls. The people of this pueblo feared this young girl as a witch. She likely wasn't a witch at all, but maybe suffered from some sort of mental disorder that made the people think she had evil spirits inside her. In the face of the horror of the murder of this young girl, somebody that loved her so truly and deeply came by before they sealed that tomb for the final time and put her doll in there with her to take into eternity. And as I stood there in that pottery shop in this century on that day, I could feel that connection to the past and the family and the tragedy they experienced. I got just a little glimpse into the little bit of humanity, into that child's last tragic moments.
Ryan Howell is an archaeologist and storyteller who grew up in Texas. In April, he was voted runner-up in the OK So Story Group yearly Grand Slam storytelling competition in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he currently lives. Next on Tales from the South, Tyler Thompson thinks he knows the outcome, but is instead blindsided in A Tough Lesson to Learn.
It was the summer of 1993, and I was eagerly awaiting my chance to view the video resume of a Hollywood actor I had recently met at a party here in Little Rock. My friends John and Corky had invited me to one of their frequent get-togethers at their condo. For the purposes of this story, we'll call the actor Jay. He had Arkansas roots and even graduated from Hendricks College prior to his heading out to the East and West Coasts seeking fame and fortune on stage and screen. Now, Jay would be the first to admit that he wasn't the leading man type, like Cary Grant or Paul Newman. But he was an excellent character actor who filled the bill on an occasional TV sitcom or drama as the quirky brother, estranged uncle, and/or disgruntled butler. He was the kind of actor whose name you wouldn't know when he came on screen, but he had a face that you recognized, like the neighbor you have never been introduced to, but know when you see him. Jay regaled the room that evening at John Corky's place with all sorts of stories about backstage goings-on during scene or stage rehearsals. And he filled our ears full of all sorts of gossip about actors and actresses we knew, titillating us with his inside information and elucidations. He was a hoot. During that time, the AIDS epidemic was capturing media headlines with story after story about how it was overwhelming the healthcare system, exhausting family relationships, and challenging value systems. Jay had, in fact, been diagnosed as being HIV positive and had been ill a number of times in the recent past. He'd still been able to work off and on, but his most recent opportunistic infection had finally brought him home to be cared for by family and friends. Since I had been the founding president of the Regional AIDS Interfaith Network, what we called RAIN Arkansas, which established care teams in religious congregations to extend assistance in the care and treatment of AIDS patients, John and Corky thought I might enjoy visiting with Jay. So that's how I met him. In the course of that and later conversations, I learned that Jay had played a part in the early Hollywood response to the AIDS epidemic by participating in fundraisers in the entertainment industry. In fact, he had put together a tape of a number of those fundraising events for his own personal video resume on a VHS tape and added onto the second half of the tape scenes of TV shows in which he had had supporting roles with the likes of Mary Tyler Moore and Andy Griffith, just to name a couple. I told him that I'd like to take a look at that video resume sometime, if it was okay. And he said, sure, why not? I'll just drop it off at your office. And sure enough, he did just that a couple of days later, with his college friend Julie acting as his chauffeur, since Jay was becoming a bit weak at the time. I watched the tape over the next few days as time permitted. And finally, after a couple of weeks, Jay called to see if I was finished with his video and that he'd like to have it back. I told him, sure, let me go get it and I'll have it ready for you whenever you come by. And we hung up. But I couldn't find the tape. I looked everywhere. And after searching high and low around my place, I finally found it stuck on the shelf along with shows I had recorded from TV that I hoped to watch when I had the time. Except that whenever I put it back into the VCR to see if the image on the screen matched the label on the sleeved box, my heart sank. Do you happen to remember that episode on Everyone Loves Raymond, when Raymond had recorded the Super Bowl game over the tape of his and Deborah's wedding ceremony and reception? Do you recall how horrified he was? Do you remember how furious Deborah was? Well, what was on Jay's tape was not the Hollywood AIDS benefits and Jay's co-starring roles reflecting his career. What appeared was the first few frames of one of those benefits, morphing quickly into a TV broadcast of Gone with the Wind, which I had recorded a couple of weeks earlier. I was mortified. What was I going to do? Well, I called some people I knew who knew Harry and Linda Bloodworth Thomason out in Hollywood, who had cast Jay in some of their TV shows, but came up empty in efforts to recreate his tape. I called the offices of shows in Hollywood that had put on those benefits to see if I could get copies of those shows. But they said sorry, they didn't make those available to the general public. After sweating out every possible recovery process in an attempt to resurrect that video intact for Jay, and falling short with every effort, I dreaded with every bone in my body his showing up at my office, expecting those precious memories to be placed safely back into his hands. A few days later, Julie showed back up at the office and said Jay was in the car and that she'd just pick up the tape for him. I told her that I needed to speak with him myself and walked her back out to the parking lot. There he was, seated in the front passenger seat, looking a bit thinner, but with a smile on his face. Hi, Tyler. Nice day, isn't it? Weather-wise it was, but I thought I was about to bring him a thunderstorm of bad news. I told him that I really enjoyed watching the benefit fundraisers and was impressed with his body of work taped on the second part. He thanked me for my kind words and then said, but I notice that you're empty-handed. Standing at the window on his side of the car, I confessed right then and there as to how irresponsibly I had recorded over his prized possession and told him how hard I had worked to recreate it and all the people on the West Coast I had called to get duplicates and all the roadblocks I ran into and how much I had fretted over my stupid mistake and how lame-brained I felt and how I wanted to make it up to him and for him to please tell me what it would take to set things right and please, please do not hate me for this and will you ever forgive me for being so thoughtless and careless and reckless and negligent? I just kept talking 90 to nothing, not knowing when to stop. Kind of afraid that when I did, he would have the floor to give me the verbal thrashing that I deserved. I finally had to come up for air. And when I did, he just started laughing, though his exhausted lungs limited his expression of mirth somewhat. He said that he thoroughly enjoyed my little soliloquy then, just then, and that, quote, maybe I could write a scene based on what just happened and submit it to a screenwriter friend of mine back on the coast. Who knows where they might show up, unquote. After another chuckle or two, he said, Tyler, don't worry about it. Do you think I put that tape together myself? I'm an actor, not an editor. I had an editor buddy do that for me. I'll just have him make me another copy. Ha ha! You just gave me the best laugh I've had in a long time. With that, he and Julie pulled away, leaving me standing there in the parking lot with mud all over my face. And a lesson I'll never forget.
A former school teacher and almost retired optometric physician, Tyler Thompson enjoys the magic and power of putting words and sentences together to capture just the right message. His dog doesn't appreciate this. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Deb Cantrell's best friend manages to not only do something unexpected, but also downright impossible in The Duck Hunt Date.
You want to do what? Mother asked again, louder this time. We send you off to Gulf Park College for Young Ladies to teach you charm and grace and ladylike behavior. And then you come home for the holidays and want to go on a date at 3:30 in the morning? Duck hunting? Mother, please. It's a double date. Jan's invited too. She can spend the night here. It's the Hodges boys. It's Charles and Jerry. They have their own duck blind in the middle of their own rice field, and they dared us. Dared you? Well, I will have to ask your father about this one. I tried my next argument. How can we live in the duck hunting capital of the whole world, and I've never been duck hunting? Miss Arkansas County just won that beauty pageant with duck calling as her talent number. Mother had an affinity for beauty pageants that I did not share. She reluctantly checked with my father.
Well, that is quite an honor, he said. The Hodges boys have their own duck blind in the middle of their own rice field. Best duck hunting in the state of Arkansas.
Jan and I were thrilled. We planned our wardrobe and plotted how to get her hair to stay in a perfect flip while duck hunting. Last summer, we tried a fashion tip from Teen Magazine and made our own hair gel by mixing Jell-O with a half a cup of water. Lemon Jell-O for blondes like me and black cherry for brunettes like Jan. However, when we went outside to let her hair dry in the sun, bumblebees and red wasps and yellow jackets and even dirt daubers chased us everywhere. In retrospect, perhaps the night before our duck hunting date was not the best time to repeat the Jell-O experiment. Nevertheless, we jelloed our hair onto large rollers and attached our bonnet hair dryers and went to sleep looking like Russian cosmonauts, hair dryers running full blast. Next thing I know, it's 3 a.m. Jan and I sprang awake and began working on our makeup and hairdos. Random granules of undissolved Jell-O clung to our scalps, but after painful brushing, they mostly disappeared. We ratted our hair and styled it into a perfect flip. Our heads looked like pumpkins with petticoats. Then we proceeded to layer up and dress for the cold. The first layer was my little brother's clothes, jeans and flannel shirt, the warm layer. And then we put on our own clothes, the fashion layer, bell-bottom pants and turtleneck sweaters. And then we put on our father's hunting clothes, thick-lined canvas pants and camo vests, the outdoors layer. Jan wore her father's waders with suspenders to her chin. I wore my turquoise cowboy boots that Mother wouldn't let me take to college. We heard the motor of the pickup truck as it pulled in the driveway at 3:30 a.m. sharp. We blotted our lipstick and then held our breath and sprayed our perfect flips with Aquanet hairspray followed by a mist of off-bug repellent. And then we added Shalimar to our temples and wrists and staggered out to the pickup truck. When I say staggered, I actually mean waddled. Staggered would be too fast a gait to be accurate. Now, the Hodges boys were raised right, to be polite and gentlemanly. Their mama had taught them well. They were trained to say, "You look nice tonight," within the first few minutes of every date. And they were also trained to open the car door for their date and then run around and open it again when the car stopped. This was not because their date was too stupid to open her own car door, but because they were being Southern gentlemen. My mother had explained this to me over and over. I recall the shocked looks on their faces as we waddled toward them. And then Charles, the older brother, jumped out of the passenger side, held the door open, and said, "Y'all look nice this morning." I tried to step up into the little truck, but my leg would not bend through three pair of pants. I backed up and tried to hop jump in, but this did not work either. Jerry extended his arm from the driver's seat, and Jan pushed, and I slid up in the truck like a big sea lion. Now the problem was Jan. Her clothes were stuffed down in her father's waders, which were strapped on her like a giant rubber glove. She could neither run nor hop nor bend her legs at the knee, not even a little. So Jerry got out of the truck, and while I pulled her arms, the Hodges boys pushed her padded bottom into the cab. Jan and I were squished semi-upright on top of one another in the middle of that pickup cab, and they had left the heater running. Now, Jan and I were also raised right, and our mothers had trained us to never on a date say, "I'm hot." So we said nothing about that heater and just sweated like little piglets all the way to the Hodges Rice Farm in Biomeda. They eventually cracked the windows. It seems Shalimar mixed with off-bug repellent intensifies with the heat. A light was on in the kitchen, and their mother had coffee made for us. Miss Hodges took one look at us and said, "Girls, you're going to have to take those clothes off. You will never make it to the duck blind." She gave us long johns and found waders to replace my turquoise cowboy boots. We changed clothes, giggling and trying not to think about who those long johns belonged to. But of course, we could think of nothing else. Once outside, the Hodges boys both gave us shotguns. Jerry announced that Charles would now instruct us in gun safety. Charles said, "Keep the barrel pointed down at all times. Only point it up when you see a duck. When you see a duck, pull the trigger." Jerry said, "I'm carrying the shells. The guns ain't loaded. Let's go." Well, I was relieved. I really did not want to walk in front of Jan with her carrying a loaded shotgun for many reasons, all of which had to do with her well-earned reputation for tripping and falling and running into things. I had once seen her run smack into a fire hydrant on a little rock sidewalk. As we set off in the dark, I saw Jan swinging her gun widely in a large circle, up and down and ever which way, in total disregard of the gun safety lesson. And sure enough, we weren't 50 feet into that flooded rice field before she tripped and fell. They caught her before her head went all the way under, but she filled those waders with icy water. She came up, still gripping the shotgun, laughing happily. "Don't worry, I'm a lifeguard. I can swim. I got this." I saw Jerry look at his watch and heard him whisper to Charles, "I win." Apparently, the Hodges boys had wagered on this event. They took turns dragging Jan for what seemed like miles. The duck blind was a huge tin rectangular box on stilts with leafy tree branches camouflaging the roof. "Shh," they both said while we clambered inside. And then Jerry took the duck collar and amazed us. "Wow, wow, 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 wow." We didn't know he could do that. We were most impressed. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, we heard the velvet rush of wings. Whoosha, whoosha, whoosha. Charles opened the roof with a pole, and I was staring into the armpit of a giant quacking mallard. There were ducks everywhere, flapping their wings. Bam, went a gun, bam. A duck fell from the sky, kaplunk. Charles was still holding the roof pole. Jerry was still busy with the duck collar. I was holding my ears with both hands, deafened for life. The Hodges boys looked stunned and confused. "Lord have mercy," I whispered. "Janice Ann Johnson just shot a duck with an unloaded shotgun." Jan was ecstatic, hollering and dancing around with trickles of a dark substance running down her forehead, meeting the mascara running down her cheeks. Charles leaped up and grabbed her gun. "I shot a duck, I shot a duck. My gun wasn't even loaded, and I shot a duck," she exclaimed, smiling her big smile. "But you're bleeding all over your face," Charles said, clearly horrified. "Oh, no, 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 no problem. Don't worry. That's just the jello," she said, and kept smiling from ear to ear.
Deb Cantrell was raised right in DeWitt, Arkansas, educated in Mississippi and Tennessee, and now lives in Houston, Texas, and Flat Creek, Tennessee. She writes and travels and enjoys her retirement from the practice of law. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack in the River Market District of downtown Little Rock, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, Urban Garden Montessori, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
They say you weren't happy, you were ready for a change. So you changed your telephone number, and then you changed your last name. With no thought for tomorrow, no reason or rhyme. I just can't help from wondering why you turned this water to wine. Drinking this water. drinks and beers and bottles for the tears. And an old familiar flashing neon sign. And all that's left is your memory.
Writer accommodations provided by the Baker House Bed and Breakfast. More at BakerHouseNLR.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at InfraredStudioProductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.